From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. Most of us who saw the movie or play Amadeus think that Mozart was poisoned by the jealous composer Salieri. On today's Fresh Air, musicologist H.C. Robbins Landon dispenses with some of the myths surrounding Mozart's life. Also today, classical music critic Lloyd Schwartz reviews a new recording of Mozart flute quartets performed on period instruments. Jazz clarinetist and composer John Carter tells us about Shadows on a Wall, the conclusion of his five-part chronicle of the African-American experience. It premiered this week at New Music America. And Owen Gleiberman tells us what's new on home video. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Frank Stachow. The House today yielded to President Bush and approved a spending bill for the Department of Health and Human Services that does not contain a provision expanding federally financed abortions. NPR's Mara Liasson has more.
Last month, the House voted to approve a $157 billion appropriations bill for the Labor and Health and Human Services departments with a provision that federal funds could be used to help poor women who were victims of rape or incest get abortions. The president vetoed the bill. The House failed to override his veto. And today, abortion rights supporters admitted they wouldn't attempt to change the bill again. But they did warn that the Senate might be able to restore the more liberal abortion language this year and that they would be back next year to try to liberalize federal abortion funding for rape and incest. The debate today was heated. Abortion rights lawmakers called their opponents anti-choice. Republican Henry Hyde of Illinois responded, calling his opponents the pro-killer crowd, the death squads of the left. At the Capitol, I'm Mara Liasson.
Republican efforts to cut capital gains taxes this year ended today when the Senate refused for a second time to cut off a Democratic filibuster against the proposal. Leaders of both parties agree the battle will be renewed early next year. Polish political leader Lech Wałęsa appealed to a joint session of Congress today for a new Marshall Plan, calling economic aid the best investment for peace and freedom in Poland. Although he asked for aid in his hour-long speech, Wałęsa made clear his view that economic assistance was an investment and not charity, saying his country wanted to be treated as a partner and a friend. President Bush today addressed the annual AFL-CIO convention with Wałęsa at his side, NPR's Phyllis Crockett reports.
The packed room of union workers greeted the president with polite applause, but they went wild when the president acknowledged Wałęsa. The president used the nearly half-hour speech to talk not about labor issues facing this country, but labor issues in countries around the world. Mr. Bush said the U.S. has a role in Poland's future.
Today I appeal to and call on the American labor movement, the business community, and government to look for ways to support a partnership for progress in Poland for the sake of a nation and a people that need and deserve our help.
In 2 weeks, AFL-CIO President Lane Kirkland travels to Poland as part of a presidential mission. I'm Phyllis Crockett at the White House.
Montana's state wildlife director said today that hunters and ranchers will be free to kill bison that stray from the northern Yellowstone National Park this winter. Experts predict that as many as 200 of the animals might be killed. On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrial Average rose more than 22 points today to close at 2632.58. Advances led declines 3-2 on volume of 155 million shares. This is NPR News. Efforts to form a government with a greater non-communist representation continued in East Germany today, while West German leaders met to discuss possible economic aid for the East. NPR's Mike Schuster reports from East Berlin.
The West German government is prepared to provide increased economic support for East Germany, but only if the East German Communist Party agrees to hold free elections. That has also become the price the Communist Party must pay for the cooperation of East Germany's four officially tolerated minor parties in a government under the new Prime Minister Hans Modrow. The minor parties are also demanding a change in the constitution, which ensures the Communist Party's preeminent role in East German political life. There are reports that such a proposal to end the party's political monopoly could be presented to the parliament here as early as Friday. I'm Mike Schuster in East Berlin.
The Nicaraguan government said today it has offered a compromise and ceasefire talks with the Contras. Sandinista negotiators have dropped their demand that the rebels demobilize in exchange for a rebel promise to return to their base camps in Honduras. A government spokesman complained the Contras have shown not an inch of flexibility in four rounds of talks starting last Thursday at the United Nations. There was no immediate response by the rebels, but administration officials say the Contras have told them evacuation from Nicaraguan territory is not feasible. The State Department said today the Soviet Union has shipped advanced MiG-29 aircraft to Cuba. Spokesman Richard Boucher called the move wholly inconsistent with Moscow's stated desire to promote peace in Central America. Boucher refused to provide details on when the aircraft arrived in Cuba or how many were sent. The Securities and Exchange Commission today asked stock exchanges to review their computer systems and consider backup units in light of higher trading and volume, as well as recent susceptibility to disruptions. The action is voluntary, but the SEC held out the possibility of new rules requiring the move. I'm Frank Stacio in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. The play and movie Amadeus were very popular and introduced Mozart's music to new audiences. But as music history, they weren't very accurate. My guest has often been called upon to set the record straight. H.C. Robbins Landon is one of the world's leading musicologists. He's the author of several books about Mozart, including 1791, about Mozart's last year, and a new book called Mozart, The Golden Years, about the last decade of Mozart's life. Landon is also an authority on Haydn and is considered the man most responsible for the recent revival of Haydn's work. He founded the Haydn Society in 1949. Landon lives in the southwest of France, but he's American-born and is currently visiting the States. I asked him why he thinks Mozart is the greatest composer in history.
Well, when I was 13, I thought this too, but in those days they thought I was mad because everybody knew that Mozart wasn't the greatest composer. Bach, Beethoven, Wagner, and so on. But I didn't believe this. I thought it was Mozart. And although there are many things I didn't understand at the age of 13, I did understand one thing. I didn't know what the word meant, but if I'd been able to express it, it's the word ambivalence. Nowadays, where the world is about to blow up in front of us, many people don't think that the great positive answer of Beethoven is the answer. Think of this Fifth Symphony. Well, it starts out with this tremendous questioning C minor, but it all ends well in C major. Well, Mozart doesn't end well. The Symphony G minor doesn't end well. The C minor piano concerto K491 doesn't end well. And I should think for many people, this rather more subtle questioning of the universe is perhaps more in tune with the times than other people's music. I am not, you understand, disparaging Wagner and Beethoven. Or Bach, that would be too stupid, because it's all part of God's cosmos, as Haydn would have said. But nevertheless, I think there is a case that people certainly have more need of Mozart than they ever did before.
I think a lot of people's knowledge of Mozart is based on the movie or the play Amadeus from the Peter Schaeffer story. And you say that a lot of the information that's in there is really pure myth. So why don't we start there before we get any further? Was Mozart really a lout who laughed a lot and was very obnoxious and not worthy of the talent that he had?
Well, it's not a view to which I subscribe, obviously, and it's not a view that you would be able to find in any of the 18th century sources that I've studied. But, you know, I must say this about Amadeus. Everybody's always accusing Amadeus of being a wrong description of Mozart's life, but Schaffer and the great movie is not supposed to be a biography of Mozart. It's supposed to be a biography of Salieri, mediocrity, and jealousy. And this is particularly the case with Miklos Forman's movie. So I think, in a sense, we're doing them an injustice if we try to imagine that that's the way they think Mozart was like. They're making a point, aren't they? They're making a point with the cultivated and subtle and rather devious Salieri, and in order to make it stand out more strongly from their particular scenario, they're making Mozart out to be much more loutish and boorish than he obviously ever was. So, no, he certainly wasn't that way. On the contrary, look, if you'll forgive my putting it this way, a courtier, and Mozart was a courtier, he was a member of a huge international court that spoke 15 languages at least. And in the movie, certainly, Constanze would not have been presented to the Emperor Joseph II with a décolleté that practically revealed her nipples. I mean, that would, he would have lasted just 5 minutes. And this is the kind of thing, of course, that really exasperates people who know about the 18th century, because this is not the way it worked at all. You wouldn't do that now if you were being presented to the Queen in England. I mean, it was never enter anybody's head. Well, it wouldn't have entered their head either. You see, so once you start having these liberties, it's like the thin edge of the wedge. Pretty soon the wedge is more important than anything else.
Now, did Salieri poison Mozart, as the movie and the play Amadeus?
Certainly not. You couldn't poison people in late 18th century Vienna. They had doctors examining the corpses. Nobody got put in the grave without there being a medical man come from the city of Vienna examining the corpse, particularly if the corpse was swollen as Mozart was, or if he didn't die of obvious old age.
What did he die of?
Well, the latest, mind you, I'm not qualified to discuss that, so I have to rely on the opinions of others. And the latest medical opinion, which is causing a great deal of interest, is by an Australian doctor called Dr. Peter Davis, who has analyzed Mozart's last illness. And I'm putting it in its very briefest. Mozart had a kidney ailment known as the Schönlein-Henoch syndrome, which was unidentifiable in the 18th century. So they couldn't have known how to treat it, even if they'd wanted to. And in the end result, This went into a series of chain reactions, which ended up by Mozart's whole body being swollen up with moisture, hence the bloodletting. They wanted to get the pressure off the heart. And what happened was an enormous collapse of the nervous system and heart failure. And that is a result of this kidney illness. That probably, if there are any doctors listening, they're throwing their hands up in horror. But this is basically what Dr. Davis is saying.
H.C. Robbins-Landon is my guest. He's one of the world's experts on Mozart and Haydn, and his new book about Mozart is called Mozart, The Golden Years. You say that you think Mozart was manic depressive, that he suffered from terrible mood swings, and that those mood swings are reflected in the music.
Well, this is, again, that distinguished Dr. Davis, whom I've never met, by the way, the Australian doctor's theory that Mozart was a manic depressive, and he quotes a lot of contemporary reports by Mozart's friends, sister-in-law, which he says are absolutely clinically typical of a manic depressive, and people who have a kind of psychomatic nervous disorder, when they're up, they're very, very up, and when they're down, they're absolutely desperate. The difference is between all of us who have ups and downs is that we don't write the C minor concerto when we're down, and Mozart did. And if you examine the pattern of these really far-out and violent works, or indeed works of extreme that show extreme pressure, where in some cases even the manuscript shows great pressure, like that of the C minor concerto. Well, if you add them all up, as I tried to do in this book in a kind of a little graph, you can see there is a kind of pattern, because the highs of a man like that can last many months, and the lows can last 5 days. But 5 days is enough if you're writing at Mozart speed to turn off the C minor piano concerto and leave an ink blot on history.
Well, you're talking about the C minor piano concerto. I want to play an excerpt of the Symphony No. 40 in G minor. Now, do you think that this is an example of...
Absolutely. It's one of the classic examples of all Mozart of violent disorder. Mm-hmm. Particularly, well, the first movement and the last movement, in the middle of the last movement, we even get the 12-note scale, 11 of the 12-note scale thrown at us. I mean, this is nervous of the violent disorder in an orderly system of notes, which hardly had ever been expressed like that before.
What about the beginning of the first movement?
Well, the beginning is also with these divided violas. There's a sense of anguish and a sense of frustration and restlessness. What do you suppose they thought of that symphony when they first heard it?
Let's hear it now.
Thank you.
Well, what did they think about that when they first heard it?
Well, we don't know because we have no contemporary newspapers. It's not like London where when Haydn was there 2 years later, we sometimes have 5 daily newspaper reports the next day what everybody thought about the concert. We don't know what they thought about Mozart's concerts. We don't have, except for an occasional diary, we don't have a single report about any of these concerts that Mozart played in. We don't even know how the orchestra was set up, how many were in the orchestra, where the piano was placed. Our ignorance is absolutely bottomless.
We know, we just heard an excerpt of the recording of Franz Bruggen conducting the orchestra of the 18th century in the Symphony number 40. I'm wondering what you think of the period instrument movement, which Franz Bruggen is one of the leaders of.
Well, I think it's absolutely essential for us to know what Mozart's orchestra sounded like, what the piano's concerto sounded like with an 18th century piano or a reproduction thereof. Malcolm Bilson, as you know, has now recorded all of them, conducted by John Elliott Gardiner, and they're just absolute revelations. I mean, this is obviously, we have to know how this sounded in order to make sense out of the music. Now, this doesn't mean that next time we hear Muti conducting the Philadelphia Orchestra in a huge hall that he's going to try to do it with a forte piano, because you wouldn't hear it. There are real problems about trying to turn 18th century sound into 20th century realism and exigencies. And I don't think it would be both foolish and very ill-advised if we forced every orchestra to have a sort of a whole second section of only original instruments, so that when they marched out to start the evening with Mozart or Haydn, that they had one set, and then they all changed into their 19th century garb for the rest of it. It's not on.
Let's take a short break, then we'll talk some more. And my guest is one of the world's foremost musicologists, H.C. Lind and Robbins. His new book is a book about Mozart called Mozart, The Golden Years. This is Fresh Air.
Fresh Air is produced live at WHYY in Philadelphia and distributed by National Public Radio.
My guest, H.C. Robbins Landon, is one of the world's authorities on Mozart and Haydn, and he's the founder of the Haydn Society. His new book, Mozart, The Golden Years, is his fourth book on the composer. I'm really interested in hearing what it was like to be a court composer. What were the official positions Mozart held within the court in Vienna, where he lived?
Well, he finally got a position with the Emperor Joseph II at the end of 1787 for 800 gulden a month. This was not a very bad salary. It wasn't a brilliant salary, but it was bad. It was what, for instance, somebody who was in charge of the castle of the Belvedere, which is one of the court's official Viennese castles, got too. Haydn got 1,000 gulden. But, of course, Haydn was much older. The biggest position in Vienna, which Mozart was going to get, was that of cathedral chapel master, and that he was waiting for the President Kummermann to die, but the President Kummermann, Leopold Hofmann, lived on until 1793. If Mozart had got that job, and he would have, that would have been 2,000 gulden and all sorts of perks such as free firewood, free candles, half a pig, and so on. Now, at the court, what Mozart was expected to do was simply to compose music. They really gave him the job by default because they didn't want him, as it were, in real financial trouble, and people saying, how is it possible a Viennese court doesn't take care of somebody like that? This we know because of a document after Mozart died where they said they gave him the job mainly because they thought it would be too embarrassing to have him have to go elsewhere to get one. So they didn't really know quite what to do with Mozart officially, so he ended up writing a huge quantity of dance music, which turned out to be the greatest and finest dance music written before Johann Strauss, but it was, in a sense, a terrible waste of his talents. What he should have been doing is writing Italian opera and German opera and so on. Now, Mozart had to be very well-dressed. His wife, Constanze, had to be well-dressed. They had to represent the court, and this was one of the troubles, that they had to live at a rather high level of just a day-to-day existence because they appeared so much in public, which meant they had to have beautiful clothes, and clothes were very expensive. And since Mozart was rather scatterbrained in his dealing with money, not Constanze, she was much better, but he obviously didn't care and he was very generous. Like many artists, it really didn't interest him very much. So that it wasn't until 1791, after 5 rather lean years, when the public withdrew its support, nobody knows quite why, of Mozart's subscription concerts, that in 1791 Mozart was able to begin to get his finances back into shape again, and all he needed to have done was just live a little longer. He would have had no problems whatever. If he lived just 2 more years, no problems.
Mozart's last opera, one of his last pieces, was The Magic Flute. And you talk in your books about there's how much there is from the Masons that shows up in the music of The Magic Flute. Mozart had joined the Masons.
1784, yes.
Yeah, so that was about 7 years before his death. What were the Masons like then? And then we could talk about how he incorporated them musically into The Magic Flute.
Well, the Masons were an organization, a charitable organization, dedicated really to the proposition of the Enlightenment. In other words, freedom of all men are brothers, freedom of politics. They were against despots. Of course, they were behind the French Revolution. They were behind the American Revolution. Washington was a master Mason. So was Franklin, Jefferson, Adams. The whole lot of them were Masons. The Declaration of Independence reads in many respects like a Masonic document, and so does the Bill of Bill of Rights. Now, Mozart, who was a passionate Mason, by 1791 began to think, along with his friend and librettist, also a fellow Mason, Emanuel Schikaneder, that Masonry was in serious trouble, and it was. The reason for that being that the Austrian court thought, with some justification, that the Austrian Masons would rather like to overthrow the monarchy and substitute a republican government. This certainly, many Masons, was a thought that they entertained. And there was a big Freemasons conspiracy that my clever wife uncovered in the Viennese archives in 1791 that's published in this new book, The Golden Years, which shows that the Austrian government did have a certain amount of reason to worry about the Masons. And in fact, by 1793, the Masons were practically out of existence, and by 1795 they were banned and remained banned in Austria until 1918. I believe that what Mozart and Schikaneder were trying to do was to salvage Masonry by writing a brilliant Masonic opera. One of the symbols in the Magic Flute are three. There are three boys, three flats in the signature. There are three ladies, and there, of course, there are the famous three chords. Now, one of the Masons' knocks is thump-bum-bum. Bum, 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 bum. Now, this particular set of knocks in the 18th century was for the second grade. There are three grades of Masonry. There is the ended apprentice, and then there's a master Mason. In between times, there is a second degree called fellow craft. And this knock represented the fellow craft, or second degree, in the 18th century in Austria. And the reason for that was that Tamino, who is, as it were, symbolic of the Masons, cannot yet be a master Mason because he hasn't undergone his rituals and his purification of fire and water, which happens towards the end of the opera, remember? So at the beginning, when Mozart starts to show you that it's a Masonic opera, he does it right away in the middle of the overture. He stops the music dead, and in come these three Mason calls, which every Mason in the audience will have recognized, perhaps with a certain frisson.
Let's listen to those chords that you're talking about. This is in the middle of the overture from The Magic Flute. Well, shortly after The Magic Flute was written, the Masons were banned in Austria till 1918. Was The Magic Flute banned as well?
Well, they couldn't do that because The Magic Flute was circulated all over Central Europe by then. It was a huge international, from the standpoint of the German-speaking countries, hit. So they tried two things. They tried to put out a pamphlet in which they tried to rewrite the message of the Magic Flute, and Masonry is nowhere even mentioned. And then a year later, that was in 1794, and 1795, they got out another party line, how you ought, as a proper, sensible Austrian, to regard the Magic Flute. And these two particular documents I've published for the first time in English as appendices, short and abbreviated, because they go on and on and on, in my golden years, because I thought it would be interesting to see how a police state tries to deal, even in the late 18th century, with these problems.
You've devoted a lot of your career to publishing the unpublished work of Haydn, and also to changing his status from a second-rate composer to an important composer. What made you gravitate toward his music and spend so much of your life with it?
Well, when I was 13, I was at Asheville School in North Carolina. Thomas Wolfe, not Thomas Wolfe.
Yes.
And I had an amazing music teacher there called Matthias Cooper. And I said to him, I said, Professor Cooper, I would love to devote my life to music. What should I do? And he said, well, I don't really think you're going to knock Horowitz off the concert platform. I don't think this is going to be your thing. I think you ought to do something about Haydn. And I said, why should I do something about Haydn? And he said, because there's no Gesamtausgabe of Haydn. I said, what's a Gesamtausgabe? And he said, Opera Omnia, all the works, like Mozart and Beethoven. Ah, I said, Professor, you mean all the other composers like Mozart, Beethoven, Bach have complete editions, collected editions? He said, yes. I said, but how come Haydn doesn't have one? He said, well, that's a long story, and it's because much of his music is owned privately by princes who live in out-of-the-way places in Central Europe. And we don't even know how much Haydn wrote. There's no catalog of his music, and nine-tenths of what we believe he wrote is still unpublished. So then he played me a recording of Symphony No. 93, brand new in those days, this is 1939, by Sir Thomas Beecham. And I listened to this amazing symphony, and I said, Professor Cooper, you mean there are 104 symphonies like that? And he said, yes, more or less. I said, but they're crazy. He said, that's what I'm telling you. So I said, how do I go about doing this? He said, you've got to learn the tricks of the trade. You mustn't just take a liberal arts education. That won't do you any good. You've got to go to a conservatory as well. So I ended up at Boston University, which was both a university and a conservatory. It had Carl Geiringer, the great Haydn expert, and who wrote written books on Brahms and musical instruments. And I went to study with him because he was the only Haydn expert in this country. And I learned all the tricks of the trade at the conservatory, harmony and counterpoint and so forth. And in 1947, when I was finished, I shot off to Europe to try to get to grips with the original sources. And with interruptions, I've been there ever since.
Are you surprised you take it for granted that the stock of certain composers goes up and down over the years, over the centuries?
Over the centuries, no, because that's the natural processes of the time, the Great Reaper. Vivaldi is, of course, the classic case. Vivaldi is still number one on the best-selling CD in England, and it's also number seven, another recording. And it's gone on that way week after week after week after week. Displaced for a year, you will be fascinated to hear by the Elgar Cello Concerto, also in two different recordings. This is a phenomenon I think is absolutely weird. It's not that I don't like the Elgar Cello Concerto, but why this introspective, brooding, melancholy piece that have become a bestseller is it must mean that people need that kind of music, isn't it? It must mean also they need Vivaldi as a kind of music, and it must mean now that Mozart has become, as it were, the most popular composer in 1989, it must mean they need Mozart. Well, when they don't need Mozart, it's obviously, for instance, 100 years ago, they needed him a lot less. They needed heroic music in the 19th century, didn't they? Well, now, as I said at the beginning of this program, they need maybe less heroic music. And as for the ups and downs, George Sell used to tell me, he said, Robert, you know, the musicologists think they influence public opinion, but you know they don't. The public knows exactly. It's made up its mind which of the Haydn symphonies it wants to hear, and it's more or less the 12 we all play, and that you are not going to make them change their mind and substitute a different 12 because they like these better, and on the whole, their choice is right. I think there is something to be said for Vox Dei, Vox Publicum, Vox Dei, and I should think, moreover, that all you can do is what I did in the case of Haydn, where they didn't have any choice because a lot of the stuff wasn't published, was to get it all published, and the public is then going to make up its mind what they want to hear in the future and what they don't want to hear.
Okay, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
My pleasure.
H.C. Robbins Landon's new book, Mozart, The Golden Years, is his fourth book on the composer. He's also the founder of the Haydn Society and the author of the definitive series of books, Haydn, Chronicle, and Works. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. Next time, my guest will be John Fairchild, the publisher of Women's Wear Daily and W. He has a reputation for turning favored designers into stars while gossiping about others. His annual list of what's in and what's out has become an institution. I hope you can join us.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. As a musician, John Carter is best known for his role in creating a place for the clarinet in contemporary jazz. As a composer, his most ambitious work is a series of five suites chronicling the African-American experience. The final part just premiered at New Music America. Coming up, we meet John Carter. Also, classical music critic Lloyd Schwartz reviews a new recording of the Mannheim Quartet performing Mozart flute quartets. And film critic Owen Globerman checks out Vengeance Is Mine. It's a Japanese movie from the late 70s, now out on home video. Owen says its portrait of a serial killer is as chilling as Scorsese's Taxi Driver. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Ann Taylor. The Battle of San Salvador appeared to be moving in the government's favor today as troops drove guerrillas from working-class neighborhoods. Rebel forces hold positions in several neighborhoods in and around the capital, but the five-day rebel offensive has been stalled by a combination of air power, numbers, and a lack of popular support. Casualty figures are not complete, but it appears that more than 500 people have been killed in El Salvador, including civilians, and more than 1,000 others have been wounded. President Bush announced today his support for a plan to raise salaries for members of Congress and other top government officials by 35% or more, while tightening ethics rules. NPR's Cokie Roberts reports.
Members of Congress are hoping this pay package does not stir up the same kind of public firestorm that a planned raise at the beginning of this session created. At that point, a presidential commission recommended a boost of more than 50% from the almost $90,000 members now make. But the heat of public sentiment was such that lawmakers voted down the raise rather than risk getting burned. This time, the House would receive only a little more than a 7% increase, reflecting cost of living adjustments since the last raise. A further increase of about 25% would take effect only after the next election, so voters would have a chance to let their opinions be known. And the pay increase would be tied to an elimination of all outside income, including speaking fees, law practices, and service on corporation boards. House leaders are trying to characterize this plan as an ethics package, not a pay raise, but members are still skittish, waiting to see what the public reaction will be. I'm Cokie Roberts at the Capitol.
After a long day of talks, Israeli Prime Minister Shamir says his government's differences with the Bush administration are only over details when it comes to peace talks, including the Palestinians. But as Barry Schwied reports, talks that the U.S. have been hoping for still seem elusive.
Shamir said there are obstacles still and that it will take time. He placed the blame on the PLO, saying there still aren't Palestinians able to negotiate with Israel. After Shamir's meetings with President Bush and Secretary of State James Baker, U.S. officials did not blame anyone directly for the continuing deadlock. But Baker and other officials stressed that apart from Israel's request for assurances, the Arab side hasn't said whether or not it approves of the U.S. plan. The White House, meanwhile, issued a statement calling for flexibility on all sides. For National Public Radio, this is Barry Schwied at the State Department.
On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrials closed up over 22 points to close at 2,632.58 on volume of some 155 million shares. Trading was only moderate as advancing issues led declines 9-5. This is NPR News.
This is Fresh Air. Classical music critic Lloyd Schwartz has a review of a new album of 18th century flute quartets played on original instruments by the Mannheim Quartet. Lloyd says this was music for light entertainment.
In the mid-18th century, one of the great musical centers was the German city of Mannheim. The court orchestra there was probably the most brilliant in Europe. Mozart visited Mannheim in 1777, part of a European tour with his mother that ended in Paris. He was 21, and his 4.5-month stay in Mannheim was a major turning point in his life. It's where he met and fell in love with the 15-year-old soprano Aloysia Weber. 5 years later, he married her younger sister, Constanza. And the virtuosity of the Mannheim musicians was a profound influence on his musical style. He composed some impressive pieces there, including 7 violin sonatas and his first 2 mature piano sonatas. Mannheim was also a flute-making center, so it's not surprising that Mozart composed 2 flute concertos there and 3 flute quartets, all commissioned by a Dutch officer named De Jonge. If I were an early instrument ensemble for flute and strings, I might call myself the Mannheim Quartet, which is exactly what flutist Douglas Worthen, violinist Julie Levin, violist Anne Black, and cellist Joan Esch did when they joined forces in 1987. Titanic Records has just released their first recording, and appropriately enough, it begins with a gracious performance of Mozart's C major flute quartet. Mozart was impatient with these flute commissions, and he once wrote to his father that the flute was an instrument he couldn't abide. But that was Mozart's problem. The quartet on this recording by the Mannheim Quartet is a beautifully made piece in 2 movements. In fact, the second movement, a set of variations marked andantino, Mozart used again nearly 4 years later in the variations movement of his magnificent serenade for 13 wind instruments, none of which was a flute. That masterpiece was written for the court orchestra of Munich, which consisted of the same virtuoso players as the Mannheim Orchestra. They had all moved to Munich when the Prince Elector, Karl Theodor, became Elector of Bavaria. Here's the lovely 5th variation, Adagio. The early instruments played by the Mannheim Quartet give the Mozart and the other 18th century flute quartets on this recording, by Pleyel, Viotti, and Haydn, a gentle, soft-focused sound that's more intimate than the more brilliant sound of modern instruments. Douglas Worthen's eight-key boxwood and ivory flute was made in London in 1804 by George Astor, who had moved there 22 years earlier from, where else, Mannheim. George's brother, John Jacob Astor, gave up flute making in 1797 for fur trading in America. I wonder what ever happened to him. The program booklet includes a picture of Worthen's flute and the other instruments. There's no picture of the players, though. I think one of the problems of the early music movement is that the instruments sometimes seem more important than the players or the music. And with such fine musicians as these, that's a distinct disservice.
Lloyd Schwartz is classical music editor for the Boston Phoenix. This is Fresh Air. As a musician, John Carter has helped create a place for the clarinet in contemporary jazz. As a composer, his most ambitious work is a series of five suites called Roots and Folklore, Episodes in the Development of American Folk Music, tracing the music from Africa to bebop. The final suite, Shadows on a Wall, was just released on Gramavision Records. The work just had its world premiere at New Music America. Among the musicians performing in Carter's octet is trumpeter Bobby Bradford, with whom Carter has collaborated since the mid-60s. They both grew up in Texas and met in Los Angeles through Ornette Coleman. From Carter's Shadows on a Wall, this is Hymn to Freedom. Last piece in Shadows on the Wall, Hymn to Freedom, is it's music and text. It's partly a song, which you really haven't written many of, I think.
Well, it's kind of a summation, I guess, in my mind. The Hymn to Freedom, which says essentially that the African made many contributions to this country being what it is, and the black American remains quite loyal as a group of people to this country to this day. It is our home, and it is what we're interested in and concerned about, but we have not come to a point of enjoying all the things that the country has to offer all of its citizens. Okay?
In some of the pieces on Shadows on a Wall, you're paying homage to music of an earlier period in America, but you're doing it with the language of very contemporary jazz.
Thank you.
ask you a little bit about how you balance those two when you're writing, for instance, 52nd Street Stomp, paying homage to music of the 40s and 50s, but using a musical language of the late 1980s.
Well, I tried to do the whole series like that. I never tried to capture any of the period music to actually capture that music in terms of writing in that vernacular. I always tried to make reference to whatever period it was, but use whatever contemporary techniques are mine. And I don't know, it worked pretty well as long as I thought of it that way.
You're really one of the musicians who has found a place in contemporary music for the clarinet. The clarinet seemed to disappear with bebop from jazz, but a few musicians, like yourself, found a place for it in contemporary music. Did you ever despair that you wouldn't be able to find a place in modern music for you and your instrument?
No, I never did. Not sure that ever occurred to me. I'm a woodwind player, and by that I mean I play the family of saxophones and flute, and fooled around with the oboe a little bit. And so I have been involved with the woodwind family for very extensively, and my the thought that was strongest on my mind was to try to play, to be, once I decided to just play one instrument, I wanted that instrument to be the one that I could most express, that I could best express my musical ideas with. And after a lot of thought, the clarinet seemed to be the thing that I could do that best on.
The clarinet, I think, is a more technically demanding instrument. It's just easier to get squeaks, easier to lose control. I think you need a more developed embouchure to play clarinet. Did that ever pose problems for you, especially in playing the outside kinds of music that you've played over the years? You know, the avant-garde kind of music where you yeah. need control not only in the main register, but also in high squeaky parts. You need to have control while you're losing control.
Yeah, that's true. Bothers me every day. It is a very technically demanding instrument, and I literally every day I work on the instrument and I'm seeking to find new things on it. It's an instrument that I enjoy very much. It has tremendous range. And is very colorful in the various registers and ranges of the instrument. And many things can be done with it. It is given to squeaking on occasion. And, you know, you try to go with the squeaks and find out where they come from and make use of them when you want to rather than when they want to come.
A saxophone cuts through a band much more than a clarinet does. Was it ever a problem being heard?
Yes, it is, and I think this is was one of the problems with the clarinet during the bebop period. It was not an instrument that made the revolutionary kinds of statements that bebop had to make. It was a revolutionary kind of music, and the instruments that had to make that music were instruments that had to have, you know, the sound, the kinds of sound and volume and the properties for cutting through that had to be used at that point. Clarinet was, I think, kind of one of the reasons for its falling out of favor was its inability to have the strong voice that the other the saxophone and trumpet and trombones I have.
You know, you use the word revolutionary to describe bebop. When you and Bobby Bradford founded your quartet in Los Angeles in the mid-1960s, did you think of the music you were playing then as revolutionary?
No, we didn't. I don't know how we thought of it, but you know, we never thought of it as being revolutionary music. I think my own thoughts, and I would think Bob's thoughts also, were that we had come up, both of us, during the bebop period, and had gone through, seen and been involved in the beautiful development of that music on through the post-bebop period. And my thought always was that if Dizzy Gillespie and Charlie Parker and the other bebop giants could had given to the world and to us musicians the step that that music had taken, the revolutionary step that that music had taken, then it was incumbent upon us to try to take that step and make another step in other directions with using what had been given to us. One, and two, it never occurred to me that I could play anything else on the alto saxophone that Charlie Parker hadn't already played. And so, more than having revolutionary thoughts concerning what we were doing then, I think we just thought that there were other things out there and perhaps we could find some of them.
Okay, thanks so much for talking with us.
Thank you so much.
Jazz clarinetist and composer John Carter. This is from the latest album by the Bobby Bradford John Carter Quintet, Coming On. This is Fresh Air. Let's see what they're working on at All Things Considered and check in with Linda Wertheimer. Hi, Linda.
Hi, Terry. Noah Adams is still out west, taking his train ride from Stanley, North Dakota today to Essex, Montana, with a stopover in Havre. And we have a piece from Wyoming, continuing with our coverage of the Centennial States, on water rights being restored to the Indian tribes after all these years. The opening of East Germany is causing concerns all over Europe. We'll have reactions from the Soviet Union, and we'll also have the anticipation of the Western European countries who are holding an economic summit this weekend to discuss just precisely what is going on in Germany.
Thanks, Linda. That and more coming up on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. A chilling Japanese thriller called Vengeance is Mine has just been released on home video. Critic Owen Gleiberman has this review.
Murder and mayhem turn up on our movie screens about as often as the closing credits. Yet it's rare that a film gets deep inside the mind of a killer. Among the few that have are Martin Scorsese's Taxi Driver, Michael Mann's Manhunter, and an extraordinary Japanese movie called Vengeance is Mine, which was made in 1979 by the audaciously talented Shohei Imamura. This feverish psychodrama takes off from the case of an actual serial killer who haunted Japan for several months in the mid-60s. What fascinated Imamura was the length of time the killer was able to elude the police, even with his wanted poster everywhere. He did it by assuming various identities and by manipulating his victims into a perverse bond of trust, even when they knew who he was. The killer commits his first crime about 10 minutes into the movie, in one of the most startling sequences ever filmed. As he tussles with his victim, making random thrusts with a stiletto, we're forced to confront homicide not as a jazzy, movie-ish catharsis, but in all its earthbound horror. What's so disturbing about Vengeance's mind is how unsensational it is. Like Scorsese, Imamura creates a violent panorama far more chilling than the usual exploitative fireworks. He also gives us a memorable psychopath. The killer, named Enokizu, is played by Ken Ogata, a great actor best known here for what turned out to be the thankless title role of Paul Schrader's Mishima. In Vengeance's Mind, he plays the killer as a barrage of devious idiosyncrasies. By the second half, when the character is posing as a mild-mannered professor and sharing quarters with a prostitute who falls in love with him, Ogata's comic flourishes have begun to suggest a Japanese Brando. It's no accident this killer seems more Western, more wildly individual than the characters in other Japanese movies. The closer we get, the more we see that his pride and violence are a misguided revolt against his father, whom he hates, but also against what he sees as the bureaucratic cowardice of contemporary Japan. Whiling away the afternoons in downtown pachinko arcades, Ogata's killer is the modern Japanese as emasculated samurai, a kind of psycho without a cause. His madness is never fully explained. Instead, Imamura offers up a mosaic of clues, notably the near-incestuous relationship between the killer's wife and his father. This section of the movie attains a tumultuous eroticism. Imamura's love scenes, like his murder scenes, are almost frighteningly spontaneous. Enokizu's rage over his wife and father's taboo affair is our pathway into his character. His anger is so palpable we can't help but empathize. The form it takes is so demented we have little choice but to turn away. Vengeance's Mind has its muddled moments, and it's a little too intent on keeping an ironic distance from its tormented protagonist. Still, it's one of the only movies that succeeds at evoking the tangled humanity of a killer.
Owen Gleiberman is a Boston-based writer and critic. He reviewed Vengeance is Mine. Amy Salad and Phyllis Myers produced the interviews on Fresh Air with research assistance from Sue Spolin. I'm Terry Gross.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, John Fairchild takes us inside the fashion industry. He publishes the industry's trade paper, Women's Wear Daily. Also, some advice on how to run a successful business without being a tyrant from Max Dupree, former CEO of the furniture company Herman Miller. I'm Terry Gross, and I hope you'll join me for the next Fresh Air.